Have you ever felt like a genuine pang of guilt just for meeting a cup of coffee at 2 in the afternoon?
Oh, absolutely.
Or maybe you've beaten yourself up for hitting the snooze button like 3 times because despite your absolute best intentions, you just aren't a morning person.
Yeah, the classic guilt trip.
Exactly. You just sit on the edge of the bed, rubbing your eyes, wondering why you can't be one of those, highly productive 5 a.m. go-getters you see all over social media.
Right, those hustle culture videos.
Exactly. Well, what if I told you that those feelings of inadequacy aren't personal failings at all? What if the exhaustion you're experiencing is actually just friction from running incredibly outdated software?
I mean, it fundamentally changes how you view your own life. Because when you stop looking at your daily exhaustion as like a character flaw and start looking at it as a systemic biological mismatch, the guilt just kind of evaporates.
And getting to the bottom of that mismatch is exactly what we are doing today. We're pulling from a really fascinating piece called The Metabolic Clock: Industrial Time as Legacy Code.
Which is such a great title, by the way.
It really is. And the core argument we're exploring in this deep dive is, well, it's highly provocative. The author basically makes a case that our daily schedules, when we eat, how we work, even the basic concept of the weekend, are actually just remnants of the Gilded Age.
Yeah, the Industrial Revolution.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this for a second. Imagine trying to run the latest cutting-edge AI software on a super bulky desktop computer from 1995.
Oh man, dial-up sounds and all.
Right. It's going to overheat, it's going to crash, and it's going to be wildly inefficient. That is essentially what we are doing to our bodies right now.
I think that is a much more accurate way to visualize it, to be honest. We are essentially running industrial programming on, post-industrial human hardware. But before we get into the actual biological mechanics of how this plays out in your body, it's probably important to establish the framework our source uses.
Right, the ground rules.
Yeah. We are going to be looking at a lot of empirical facts today. Things like documented labor history, the endocrinology of digestion, the genetics of sleep chronotypes.
Real hard science.
Right. Those are realities.
Right.
But the overarching thesis, we were exploring this idea that the historical shift was a deliberate capture, or like a colonization of human biology by early industrial capitalism, that is a specific debatable interpretation.
Okay, so it's a framing device.
Exactly. It's a lens.
Yeah.
But I have to say, it is an incredibly useful lens for understanding why we all feel so constantly misaligned today.
Right. It's a way to connect the dots between a 19th century textile mill and like your 2 p.m. Tuesday brain fog.
Precisely.
So if we're going to understand how this legacy code actually runs, it makes sense to start with how the industrial system hacked our most basic biological input, which is fuel.
Yes, food.
Because obviously you can't run a highly synchronized, mechanized factory floor if your workers are just wandering off to eat whenever their stomachs rumble, right?
Exactly. If you look at pre-industrial eating patterns, they were incredibly fluid.
Like how fluid?
I mean, they were based on grazing, or these feast and famine cycles, depending on the harvest, or simply eating in response to biological hunger and the availability of food.
Okay.
The rhythm of consumption was entirely tied to the rhythm of the organism and, the season.
But the factory system basically stomps on that completely, right? The source brings up the strict codification of the 3-meal day.
Yeah, that was a huge shift.
Suddenly, eating wasn't dictated by your stomach, it was dictated by the factory bell. You eat when the whistle blows, period.
Yep.
But I have to push back on this a little bit, because what about the golden rule of nutrition? Like, breakfast is the most important meal of the day.
Yes.
We've had that drilled into our heads by doctors, parents, and cereal commercials since we were toddlers. Are we really saying that's just a factory construct?
Well, what's fascinating here is that this supposedly undeniable nutritional dogma is exactly what the author classifies as modern residue.
Wait, really? Modern residue?
Yeah, it's basically a leftover behavioral modification from an industrial necessity. Historically, the heavy, mandatory breakfast was revolutionized and heavily promoted to serve a very specific mechanical purpose:
Which was?
to fuel workers for the grueling 5 to 6 a.m. factory shift.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it had absolutely nothing to do with optimal human digestion or cognitive health. It was strictly about ensuring the human biological machine had enough dense caloric energy to operate the mechanical machine until management decided to blow the whistle again.
That is wild. So the most important meal of the day was basically just like premium unleaded gas being poured into a Gilded Age factory worker.
That's exactly it. And the biological mechanism of forcing this schedule is quite jarring, actually.
How so?
Well, when you mandate eating by the clock rather than by hunger, you actually confuse the body's anticipatory insulin response.
Okay.
Pre-industrial humans ate when they secured food, and their metabolic hormones were dynamically responsive to that.
That makes sense.
But when you mandate lunch at exactly noon, day in and day out, regardless of whether a person has actually expended any real energy, you're forcing the pancreas to act like a metronome rather than a responsive biological organ.
Oh, man. So you're overriding the internal sensor with an external clock.
Exactly.
And the rest of the day follows that exact same rigid logic, doesn't it? The source notes that lunch was essentially invented as a strictly timed interruption.
Yes.
Like, it wasn't a break. It was a way to pause the assembly line for the bare minimum amount of time required to refuel without losing production momentum.
Bare minimum being the key phrase there.
Right. And dinner wasn't this leisurely, connective family gathering we like to picture. Dinner was restitution.
Yeah, it was recovery.
It was the heavy caloric load required after severe industrial depletion. Literally just to repair the physical tissue enough to do it all again at 5 a.m.
The entire cadence of human digestion was subjugated to ensure production never stopped.
And the crazy part is, we still run this code. I mean, think about it. We force kids into this exact same meal timing in school starting at age 5.
We do.
We are basically training their digestive systems for a factory floor that doesn't even exist anymore.
It's kind of absurd when you say it out loud.
It really is. But here's the thing. Even with 3 artificially scheduled meals, humans are not machines. We are organic. We get tired.
Very tired.
We all have that natural evolutionary circadian dip in the mid-afternoon. So if the factory whistle doesn't blow until 6 p.m., how did the industrial system cope with a biological machine that naturally wants to go to sleep at 3 p.m.?
By applying a patch, and specifically a chemical patch.
Okay, tell me more.
This is honestly one of the most compelling arguments in the source material.
Yeah.
It frames caffeine not as a delightful artisanal beverage or some quaint cultural tradition, but literally as a pharmaceutical productivity patch.
A pharmaceutical productivity patch. Wow.
Yeah. If you look at the historical timeline, during the explosion of factory work in the 1800s, global coffee and tea consumption absolutely skyrocketed right alongside it.
Because you needed it to mask the exhaustion of those early shifts.
Exactly.
If the biology doesn't fit the schedule, you just drug the biology.
Precisely. And to understand how insidious this is, you really have to look at how caffeine actually works in the brain.
Okay, I'm taking notes.
So throughout the day, as you expend energy, your brain produces a byproduct called adenosine.
Adenosine, right.
And as this adenosine builds up, it binds to specific receptors, essentially acting as a biological brake pedal, telling your nervous system it's time to rest and go to sleep.
Okay, so adenosine is the body's natural low battery warning.
Yes, yeah. Perfect analogy. And caffeine doesn't actually give you energy.
Wait, it doesn't?
No, what it does is physically block those adenosine receptors. It unplugs the brake pedal.
Oh my gosh.
You are still exhausted, your battery is still low, but your brain is chemically blocked from receiving the signal.
That sounds almost dangerous.
Well, for a 19th century mill worker, this chemical intervention masked severe sleep deprivation. It provided literal physical warmth in freezing, unheated factories, and it dulled the hunger pangs that came from insufficient meal breaks.
So it was just a survival mechanism.
Basically, the invention of the coffee break institutionalized this chemical intervention as a mandatory workplace necessity. You literally needed to ingest a drug to maintain the unnatural rhythm the factory demanded.
That is wild. It's like putting premium gas into a car with a broken transmission. Like, sure, it revs the engine, but it's just masking the fact that you're grinding the gears to dust.
That's exactly what you're doing.
And the irony of how we treat this today is just staggering. I mean, the source points out that we have an $80 billion global coffee industry, and we've culturally embraced this chemical dependence as, like, an identity.
Oh, yeah.
We buy cute mugs that say, I can't function before coffee, and we treat it like this quirky, relatable personality trait. But if you actually decide to go through caffeine withdrawal and your productivity drops at work, it's treated as a personal failing.
It is.
We blame ourselves for not having enough natural energy instead of questioning the completely unnatural schedule that requires us to be medicated just to get through a Tuesday afternoon.
It's a brilliant, somewhat tragic reframing, really. We've completely normalized the biological dependence. We're internalizing the blame for the exhaustion.
Yeah.
And for modern knowledge workers, this has only escalated. We've moved from a simple cup of drip coffee to highly concentrated synthetic energy drinks.
Oh, don't get me started on the energy drinks.
Right. We require a much stronger chemical dose for a more demanding, physically different kind of cognitive extraction.
Which brings us to the synchronization of all this labor. Because once you have a workforce that is fueled on a strict schedule and caffeinated enough to chemically ignore their own exhaustion, you have to actually coordinate them.
Right, you need them all working together.
Exactly. If they controlled the hour and the meal, it makes sense they had to control the day. And that leads directly to the invention of the 9-to-5 workday.
Right. And again, we need to look at the history here. The 8-hour day was codified roughly between 1914, championed most famously by Henry Ford, and 1938 with the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Right.
Now, objectively, we have to acknowledge that at the time, this was a monumental, genuine labor victory.
Oh, absolutely. A huge historical win.
It literally saved human lives by pulling workers away from 12 to 16-hour shifts.
Yeah. No one is saying we should go back to that. But the source makes a really crucial point. The logic behind setting the limit at exactly 8 hours and forcing everyone to do it at the exact same time wasn't based on what was neurologically optimal for the human brain.
Not at all.
It was based entirely on maximizing available daylight before electric lighting was cheap and widespread, and on the strict requirements of assembly line coordination. You needed every single person standing at their station at the exact same moment to physically hand the widget to the next person.
And that is the massive cognitive disconnect for the modern listener. If you are a knowledge worker, like a programmer, a writer, a financial analyst, a manager, your work requires neither continuous physical presence on an assembly line nor perfectly synchronized time with every other worker on the floor.
Right, because most modern work is asynchronous and cloud-based.
Yet the rigid 9-to-5 container completely persists.
The dreaded presenteeism.
Yes.
We measure the time the seat is warm, not the value of the thought.
Because management culture still craves predictable inputs over dynamic outputs. The cognitive mismatch here is profound.
How so?
Well, neurological research strongly suggests that human beings only have about 3 to 4 hours of peak deep cognition in a single day.
Wait, 3 to 4 hours? That's it?
That's it. You simply cannot do high-level analytical work for 8 straight hours. The brain physically depletes its glucose and requires downtime to synthesize information. Yet we still surveil the hours a knowledge worker is sitting at their desk, essentially measuring cognitive network work with a 19th century factory stopwatch.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Because it's not just about the arbitrary number of hours, it's about when those hours are forced to happen.
Yes.
The source introduces a term that I had never heard before, and it completely blew my mind. Chronotype oppression.
It is a powerful concept, yeah. And it explains so much of our modern anxiety.
Yeah.
The industrial schedule, you know, waking up at 6 a.m. to be at a desk by 8 or 9, was optimized for roughly the 25% of the population who were genetically predisposed to be morning types.
The early birds.
The early birds, exactly.
It's like forcing a nocturnal owl to work the day shift and then calling it lazy and undisciplined when it predictably falls asleep at noon.
That's a perfect way to put it.
I mean, if you are naturally a night owl, society essentially views you as having a moral character defect. You're sluggish or unmotivated.
Which is medically and biologically inaccurate. Yep. Prototypes are dictated by genetics. Specifically, variations in genes like the PER3 gene, which regulates your core body temperature and your melatonin release.
So it's literally in your DNA.
It's in your DNA. And the data shows that 30 to 40% of human beings are genetically evening chronotypes.
30 to 40%? That's a massive amount of people.
It is. And for them, their core body temperature literally does not warm up to optimal cognitive operating levels until late morning. This isn't a lifestyle preference. It is a stable evolutionary genetic trait.
So by forcing an early start time across the entire population, the industrial schedule is basically imposing a state of permanent social jet lag on a massive chunk of society.
Exactly. They are walking around with chronic measurable sleep debt, fighting their own DNA every single morning. And the systemic rigidity of this is staggering when you look at how we treat teenagers.
Oh my gosh, yes. The source goes deep into this. We know, biologically, that adolescent circadian rhythms naturally shift significantly later during puberty.
It's an evolutionary mechanism.
Right. Their hormones are literally screaming at them to sleep until 9 or 10 a.m., but school start times are still firmly anchored to this agricultural and factory logic.
Makes no sense.
We force high schoolers into a 7:30 a.m. desk under fluorescent lights and then scrap their heads wondering why they aren't absorbing algebra or why teenage depression is spiking.
Because the schedule explicitly prioritizes the synchronization of the system over the biological reality of the organism.
Man.
The evening types face lifelong productivity penalties, lower earning potential, and very real health costs simply because their internal biological clock doesn't align with a factory whistle that stopped blowing half a century ago.
It's honestly infuriating once you see the strings pulling us, but it doesn't stop at the end of the day. If they controlled the hour and the day, it only makes sense they had to scale up and control the week.
Naturally.
Which leads us to the biggest illusion of all. The weekend. I think most of us, if we're honest, assume the weekend is just like a natural law of the universe, like gravity. 5 days of work, 2 days of rest.
It feels natural because it is all any of us alive today have ever known.
Right.
But historically speaking, it is a remarkably recent invention. Prior to the industrial era, rest was woven dynamically throughout the year.
Like season to season.
Exactly. It was tied to bursts of seasonal labor, to dozens of religious holy days, to weather patterns. There was no fixed, relentless 5-2 split.
Okay.
The modern 5-day work week, as we know it, was essentially a standardized compromise, popularized most famously by Henry Ford in 1926.
Okay, but wait. Are we really saying Henry Ford didn't care about worker fatigue at all? Was this purely a cynical marketing ploy? Didn't he want his workers to actually rest and be healthy?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, Ford's motive was highly calculated and primarily economic.
Of course it was.
He realized that a workforce operating in a factory 6 or 7 days a week didn't have the time to actually use the products they were manufacturing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He didn't give them the weekend purely for physical rejuvenation. He needed to invent a consumer class.
That is brilliant, but kind of dark.
Right. He needed them to have dedicated leisure time so they could consume. Mm-hmm. They needed a weekend so they would buy, drive, and repair Ford's cars.
Wow. So the weekend was essentially invented as a mandatory consumption window. You earn your wages for 5 days, and you were given 2 days to pump those wages back into the economy.
Essentially, yes.
And the psychological toll of this, the modern residue, is everywhere. The source breaks down the biology of the Sunday scaries.
Oh, everyone knows that feeling.
When you get that pit in your stomach on Sunday night, you aren't feeling a natural human emotion. You are experiencing an anticipatory cortisol spike.
It's a physiological reaction.
It's a stress response to an arbitrary, system-imposed reset. And what about weekend binge behavior? People just go absolutely wild on Saturday, drinking, spending, overeating, basically as a desperate pressure release valve to compensate for 5 days of absolute deprivation and compliance.
Yes. The weekend acts as a necessary pressure release for the 5-day compression. But the ultimate macro-level example of this deferred living, of trading your present time for eventual promised autonomy, is the concept of retirement.
Right. The golden finish line, retirement at 65, which the source points out wasn't even a widespread cultural standard until around the 1960s.
Think about the underlying rather grim logic of retirement at 65. You are essentially making a systemic trade.
Okay.
You give the industrial economy 50 of your most energetic, capable years, your absolute prime biological time.
Yeah.
In exchange, if you survive and save enough, you are granted a final decade or two of autonomy at the very end of your life, exactly when your physical capacity and mobility are naturally declining.
That is depressing.
It is the ultimate expression of industrial time, colonizing the entire arc of a human lifespan.
Okay, so this is heavy. If the 9-to-5, the 5-day week, and our strictly scheduled meals are all just outdated software, and worse, software that is making us physically sick, chronically tired, and deeply anxious, why don't we just uninstall it?
If only it were that easy.
I mean, we know the science now. But it's not that easy, is it? Like, I can't just rebel and tell my boss I'm only working 12 to 4 p.m. because my PER3 genes says so. I'd be fired. The money is fundamentally tied to the clock.
And you have just identified the first of the 4 major constraints the source outlines that keep this legacy schedule locked in place.
Oh, okay.
That is the economic constraint. Our compensation structures actively punish deviation.
Right, because if I don't work 9-to-5, I don't get paid the same.
Exactly. If you negotiate a part-time or asynchronous schedule, you are often paid proportionally much less, you are usually stripped of health benefits, and you are culturally coded by management as not serious or uncommitted to your career.
It's like you're penalized for being efficient.
You are. The fierce management resistance to remote work post-pandemic perfectly highlights this. The system prefers the visual surveillance of the physical office over the actual, measurable productivity of the worker.
And the gig economy, which always promises to fix this, really just trades security for flexibility. You get to set your own hours, but you entirely lose your safety net.
Exactly.
But even if I somehow solved the economic piece and got total flexibility, my life is still hooked into the grid. My kid's school starts at 8 a.m. Public transit runs on a rush hour schedule. If I need a doctor, they are operating on business hours.
That is the infrastructure constraint. Our entire physical and civic world is built around the 9-to-5.
Right.
Healthcare, government offices, and childcare all run on that factory shift model, which creates the agonizing irony that workers literally have to ask for permission to take time off from their jobs just to access basic human services.
That's so true.
The physical world will not let you easily operate outside the clock.
Then there's the guilt, the cultural piece. Because even if I take a Tuesday afternoon off to rest, I feel like a failure. The rise and grind mythology is so loud, we equate working yourself to the bone with moral virtue.
Exactly. That is the cultural constraint. Over the last century, we have successfully pathologized any resistance to the industrial rhythm as laziness.
Yeah, exactly.
And that hustle culture you see on social media, that is just the complete internalization of factory logic as a personal identity. It is the worker voluntarily taking on the role of the factory boss inside their own head.
If I'm not producing visible output right now, I have no human value.
Yeah.
It's incredibly toxic. And I imagine all of the stress takes us to the final constraint.
The biological constraint, which acts as the ultimate trap.
The trap.
Yes. The system has inflicted a physiological toll that literally limits our energetic capacity to change it. Unnatural wake times cause chronic cortisol dysregulation, keeping us in a state of low-level fight or flight.
We're just constantly stressed.
Yes. Eating on a clock disrupts our insulin sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
And that chronic sleep deprivation, that social jet lag we talked about, is directly linked by medical data to obesity, diabetes, and cognitive decline. The rigid schedule exhausts the human organism to the point where organizing for systemic change simply feels impossible. You're too tired to fight the clock.
So what does this all mean? How do we actually fix this for the listener? What does the software update look like?
The author provides a very clear, scientifically grounded vision for a post-industrial schedule. First, it requires a mass systemic shift to task-based work.
Task-based work, okay.
In knowledge work, you should be evaluated entirely on the quality of the output you generate, not the hours you spend sitting in a chair generating it.
Makes sense.
If you efficiently finish your complex tasks in 3 hours, your day is done.
Good riddance to presenteeism. We measure the product, not the time.
Exactly. Mm. Second, we need chronotype responsive schedules. Workplaces and schools must offer asynchronous or multiple shift options that actually match human biological diversity, rather than brutally forcing everyone into the morning type mold.
Love that. What's next?
Third, a societal return to intuitive eating and rest. So listening to internal biological signals rather than an external clock.
Right. Eating when your body actually signals hunger, taking a nap or going for a walk when you hit that massive 2 p.m. circadian slump instead of slamming a synthetic energy drink just to stare blankly at a spreadsheet.
And finally, it requires redefining the very economic concept of productivity.
Hmm.
We have to move away from measuring how much labor can be forcibly extracted from a human being over 8 hours and instead begin measuring what the author calls human flourishing.
Human flourishing. I love that metric so much more than hours logged. So to bring this all home for you listening, if you are sitting there feeling exhausted today, if you are struggling with that pit of Sunday night dread, or if you feel deeply guilty because you do your absolute best, most creative thinking at midnight instead of 6 a.m., realize that you are not broken.
You're not.
You are not lazy. You're just experiencing the heavy friction of a Gilded Age business model that is still trying to run inside your modern biology. It's an old program.
But this raises a profoundly important question, and it's one the author hints at but leaves completely open for us to ponder.
What's that?
If we actually succeed in debugging this legacy code, if we all shift to highly personalized, asynchronous schedules based entirely on our own unique DNA and biological chronotypes, do we risk losing something essential to the human experience?
Oh.
Do we risk losing the shared social cohesion of experiencing time together? If everyone is operating strictly on their own highly optimized biological clock, does optimizing my time accidentally destroy the beauty of our time?
Wow. That is a massive, incredibly complex question to sit with. Are we trading communal rhythm for individual optimization? I want you to think deeply about that tomorrow when you reach for that mid-morning coffee. Pay attention to your own metabolic clock. Notice when the legacy code is running you instead of you running it. And maybe, just maybe, you can start treating yourself less like a mechanical steam engine and more like a biological human being. Thank you so much for taking this deep dive with us today. We'll catch you next time.